Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. This week I'll have readings from the Dallas Morning News newspaper, the New York Times, the website jstor.org, and I'm starting with this story. Black male teachers, a rarity in preschools, make a difference. This was written by Mariah Ballingit and published November 10, 2024 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. The subtitle to the story is, Innovative Program Pairs Youngest Students with Instructors They Can Relate to. Baltimore. Before 19-year-old Devontez Johnson found himself in a preschool classroom at Dorothy I. Heights Elementary, he was a senior at a nearby high school who, like many students his age, was unsure of what he wanted to do with his life. Not in his wildest dreams could he have imagined himself standing on a colorful carpet leading a gaggle of 4-year-olds in a chant and dance about phonics. Words have parts. That's syllables, he said, enunciating for effect. The preschoolers craned their heads up at Johnson and echoed him. Clap your hands now. Syllables. Stomp your feet now. Syllables. Johnson is a participant of the Leading Men Fellowship, which trains young black and Latino men to become early literacy instructors in preschool classrooms across the country. It's a program that aims to tackle several problems at once: a shortage of early educators, a dearth of black and Latino male teachers, and the acute challenges boys of color face in schools because of their race and gender. We're not only affecting change in the classroom with these school students, but we're also developing these young future educators, said Ivan Douglas of the Literacy Lab, which runs the Leading Men Fellowship. Many of the fellows, like Johnson, are recruited right out of high school. After an interview process and intensive summer training, they go to work in schools where they may be among the only male educators. Fellows make between $16.50 and $18 an hour. A former high school football lineman, Johnson knows some parents would say he looks out of place in a preschool classroom, and the statistics back him up. Less than 1% of elementary and early education public school teachers are black men, according to federal data. And that's part of the reason he wanted to do it. I really thought it was a great opportunity because I know if I saw someone like me, you know, in preschool, I'd be pretty excited, Johnson said. You don't see a lot of young black males. The next section of the article is titled, Black Boys Face Discrimination. Researchers have shown that black male students encounter discrimination before they even set foot in a kindergarten classroom, facing higher rates of expulsion and suspension from preschool, even though evidence suggests they do not misbehave more than their white peers. Boys also are far more likely than girls to be expelled. But there's a growing body of evidence that black teachers can make a difference for black students, and for black boys in particular. In the years since the Leading Men Fellowship was founded in 2016, researchers have repeatedly found that students of color seem to fare better when they have teachers who look like them. Johns Hopkins University economist Nicholas Papageorge, who is based not far from Heights Elementary, studies the impact of black teachers on black students. His research found that black teachers have higher expectations for black students than do non-black teachers. If a black student had a white teacher and a black teacher, that white teacher had systemically lower expectations, Papageorge said. His later research found black students who have a black teacher are less likely to drop out of high school and more likely to attend college. The effect of having a black teacher had the greatest impact on black boys from low-income households. The next section of the article is titled, Teachers Learn as Much as the Kids. Through his coursework, Johnson has learned the intricacies of early education, and that it involves a surprising amount of singing and dancing for someone not working on Broadway. Children learn best by repetition and when they can pair information with movements and song. Bridget Jeffries, whose preschool classroom host Johnson, said she had never worked alongside a male educator until Johnson arrived at the start of the last school year. She says she's watched Johnson grow more confident with her students, going from reserved to enthusiastic. Jeffrey said his voice and dance moves could use some work, but he performs the songs with such heart that it doesn't matter. It was so beautiful because usually you don't see men really get down to the child level, Jeffrey said. That excited them even more. A lot of kids think he's a big kid. Along with teaching at Heights Elementary, Johnson is studying political science at University of Maryland Global Campus and hopes to go into politics. His colleagues, though, are encouraging him to stick with teaching. While Johnson is there to provide targeted literacy instruction, he has been fully integrated into the school day. His second week in the classroom, he sang the class's morning greeting song in a robot voice. When a child is squirming on the carpet or wandering away from story time, Johnson is there to rein the child in. On this October day, Johnson pulls students aside to help them work on writing their names. He had only been with this cohort for a couple of weeks, but many students were drawn to him. During free time play, he encouraged a student who was working on a crayon rubbing of a leaf. "You've done a wonderful job," he said to the girl, who stared up at him, eager for reassurance. Another student interrupted him by handing him a fistful of play money. After lunchtime, as most of the preschoolers sat on the carpet, held wrapped by a story read by Jeffries, 4-year-old Cody Hendricks wandered toward the door and peered into the hallway until Johnson beckoned him back. Johnson bent his large frame to tie the boy's shoe, and then they sat together for a penmanship lesson. "What's the first letter?" he asked the boy. "K," he replied. Johnson showed him in slow motion how to draw a K. "No, I can't do it," said the boy. "It's all right," Johnson said. He urged him on. "You can do it. It just takes practice." That was the article titled, "Black Male Teachers, a Rarity in Preschools, Make a Difference. Innovative program pairs youngest students with instructors they can relate to." It was written by Mariah Bollingett and published November 10, 2024 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. My next reading is about a place I've been to many times. Memphis, the roots of rock in the land of the Mississippians. This was written by Rob Crossan and published October 18, 2024 at the website daily.jstor.org. That's J-S-T-O-R. This website is a digital library of academic journals and books. Memphis is, for many, the absolute summit, a veritable Mount Olympus of contemporary music. Were it not for the sounds that echoed around the barns and then the streets and alleys of the city, the songs we download today could all sound so very different. Yet, way before the blues and Elvis emerged, there were smaller mountains, more akin to mounds, being constructed in what is now Tennessee by the region's earliest inhabitants. From 800 to 1600 Common Era, the area now engulfed by Memphis was populated by the Mississippian people, who began the earliest examples of organized husbandry of the land. Gregory Wasilkoff explains more in a 1977 issue of Agricultural History. "Mississippian agriculture," he writes, "was the climax of a developmental process that began 3,000 years earlier with the first plant husbandry in the central Mississippi Valley. Corn and several other plants were grown in the highly productive prairie soils and tended with simple stone hoes. This intensive agriculture supported the complex society which built the great platform mounds of the southeast. By the time white traders and farmers entered the area, the culture of the Mississippians had faded, but their descendants, the civilized tribes, continued to practice the same style of agriculture with only slight modifications. The agriculture, the old fields of the Chickasaw people, was followed by the arrival of French explorers until, in 1796, the region became the westernmost area of the new state of Tennessee. The early decades of the following century saw Memphis establish itself as a city that prospered due to its nascent status as one of the great cotton hubs of the Americas, as Roger Biles explained in the 1988 issue of The Historian. The advent of the steamboat and the stimulus it provided for river commerce played a major role in the city's growth, he writes. But most significant was the arrival of the Cotton Kingdom in the Old Southwest. As the white gold spread, Memphis buyers and factors forged transportation links with neighboring planters. Planked roads, the precursors of rails, brought the cotton crops to the Bluff City, where they would be loaded aboard steamboats for other destinations. Those same roads carried food and manufactured goods back to the hinterlands. Memphis became the largest inland cotton market in the United States, as well as the major distribution center for a Mid-South region extending into western Tennessee, eastern Arkansas, northern Mississippi, and the Boot Heel of Missouri. Once the habitat of a few traders, Indians, and visiting freshwater teamsters, the booming town increasingly supported a population of cotton merchants, bankers, wholesale grocers, and, of course, slave traders. Tensions in the city between black and white citizens grew in the middle of the century, leading to one of the worst race riots yet seen in the South in 1866, today known as the Memphis Massacre. Social historian Altina L. Waller, writing in 1984, notes that the riot has been neglected by historians. The few scholarly articles in existence, she argues, describe the brutality of the riot and discuss it in the context of race relations and political reconstruction, but none has examined the riot from the perspective of the participants themselves, rioters as well as victims. One of those few scholarly articles was written by Jack D.L. Holmes, who was one of the first to attempt to tease out the politics driving the violence in a 1958 analysis in the Tennessee Historical Quarterly. In his view, Reconstruction was at the heart of the problem. During the vital years, 1865 to 1866, President Andrew Johnson attempted to carry through his and Lincoln's plans for the Reconstruction of the Southern states, lately in rebellion against the opposition of radicals in Congress, he writes. But during the first session of the 39th Congress, Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner, Pennsylvania Representative Thaddeus Stevens, and other prominent radicals attempted to substitute their own plans for Reconstruction. Many radicals admitted their motive was essentially political. They hoped to keep the South out of the Union until the president recognized Congress's power over Reconstruction and the radicals were assured of political ascendancy in the South. The rioting that began on May Day, 1866, and lasted for 3 days was, according to Holmes, triggered by two hacks colliding into each other. One driver was white, the other black. The resulting fight between the two escalated and, as Holmes documents, resulted in hundreds of persons wounded, 5 women raped, hundreds of robberies and destruction. Over 100 buildings were burned. The Freedmen's Bureau report on the Memphis race riots of 1866 notes that 48 citizens, 46 black, 2 white, were killed before the end of the violence. Waller's research shows that the supposedly citywide riots were mostly contained to a single ward. Not only were arson, assaults, rapes, robberies, and murders concentrated along South Street, but close to a third of the rioters lived in the neighborhood, she writes. Almost a third of the known participants lived along South Street, from Fort Pickering to Eccles Street. Another 10 lived along Beale Street. South and Beale Streets were part of South Memphis, one of the city's newer neighborhoods. While the entire economy of Memphis suffered from the complete collapse of the cotton trade in the first year of the Civil War, Waller writes, it was this new, economically precarious neighborhood which was most directly confronted with the dramatic social and demographic changes which accompanied the capture of Memphis by Union forces on June 6, 1862. With the Union Army, thousands of black refugees came. At the close of the war, the Freedmen's Bureau, with its schools, courts, and hospitals all located in or near Ward 6 between Beale and South Streets. Although all Memphians must have been aware of these changes, it was Ward 6, and specifically South Street, which was most significantly altered. Residents of these wards were responding to an immediate threat. Amid this simmering, fevered atmosphere, a musical form that expressed the hardships of African Americans slowly began to take shape. Blues music entered the streets of Memphis from the cotton fields beyond and made Beale Street its fulcrum. Jennifer Ryan explores this fascinating journey in a 2011 issue of Ethnomusicology. Beale Street's history goes back to 1841, she writes, but it was during the years after the Civil War that Beale became a center for black culture and music. W.C. Handy's band was headquartered on Beale when he, according to his own claim, began the work of turning the blues from a traditional genre to a popular one. The decades from the 1920s to the 1940s were its heyday. The street was home to clubs, shops, and apartments owned and run by African Americans, many of whom had migrated from the Deep South. It was the environment of Beale Street that inspired a young Elvis Presley to incorporate the sounds of blues music with the country and gospel sounds he grew up on to such incendiary effect in the early 1950s. Yet, as Elvis became the biggest entertainer in 20th century history, a slew of innovative record labels such as Stax and Royal set up shop in the city. Political and racial tensions were never far from the surface, erupting in April 1968 when sanitation workers went on a wildcat strike. As the dispute, which quickly morphed into an extension of the civil rights struggle, intensified, catastrophic tragedy occurred, as Leela I. Hamden explains in Expanding the Narrative, Exploring New Aspects of the Civil Rights Movement 50 Years Later. On April 4, 1968, Hamden writes, Charles Cabbage, along with other invaders, a group of young black college students involved in the civil rights movement, met with Dr. Martin Luther King in his hotel room at the Lorraine Motel to discuss the racial tension and anger within Memphis's poor black communities. Moments after the invaders left the Lorraine Motel, Dr. King was shot while standing on the balcony of his room. As promised, on April 8th, the invaders served as marshals at a rally and marched for Dr. King, but this time it was led by his widow, Coretta Scott King. On that day, the march remained peaceful and well organized. The invaders would accept nonviolence as a tactic once more when they served as marshals and security for the Poor People's Campaign. Following the assassination of Dr. King, several leaders of the group moved or went underground. Memphis in 2024 remains one of the poorest cities in the American South, though its draws for music lovers are immense. Elvis Presley's home of Graceland is the second most visited private residence in America after the White House. And while the city has long embraced tourism over cotton as a source of revenue, the backbreaking industry that propelled blues music is still extant. But visitors from Oslo to Osaka visit Memphis as a mecca for the rhythms that provided the bedrock for rock and roll, as the celebrated rock critic Albert Goldman explains in a 1991 issue of Conjunctions. The natural place to begin the study of the Memphis blues is Beale Street, Goldman writes. Waxing nostalgic at length, he asserts that just pronouncing the magic name is enough to flood the imagination with beguiling images. One pictures it on a Saturday night circa 1910, crowded with plow jockeys and parlor bells, river rousters and factory frills, pimps in box-back coats and beautiful browns and flouncy gowns. You envision blocks lined with gingerbread palaces and clabbered cribs, sporting houses filled with Creoles from New Orleans and gambling halls jammed with fancy men playing coon can rummy. Rising like an invisible but palpable cloud around this lively tableau were the sounds of Beale, the jumbling of ragtime pianos with wind-up victrolas, of shouting congregations with howling bluesmen, of strolling guitar pickers with scrounging jug bands, the South's most celebrated symphony. Then you take a walk down Beale today. Beale Street of the 1990s was defined by block after block of abandoned, boarded-over brick building, Goldman writes. The high times on Beale ended on the eve of World War II, when word traveled from the federal government that a new Navy base would be built just north of Memphis, provided there was a crackdown on the revelry and the crime, the profits of which were lining politicians' pockets in the form of bribes. Goldman emphasizes that Memphis's greatest contribution to the blues wasn't necessarily the music in the streets. It was the commercialization of the sound, the local musicians and entrepreneurs who translated successfully this musical patois into the idioms of mass entertainment and allowed the music to travel from Memphis to the world. Cotton picking with enslaved laborers and the sharecropping system both belong firmly to the past, as do Jim Crow and other forms of racialized violence. The musical vitality and genius that grew up in parallel, despite of, as resistance to these injustices, nevertheless continue to cement Memphis's status as a city rich in melodies, both inspiring and incendiary. That was the article titled, Memphis, the Roots of Rock in the Land of the Mississippians. It was written by Rob Crossan and published October 18, 2024, at the website daily.jstor.org. This website is a digital library of academic journals and books. Next on today's African American Hour is an obituary. Bill Lucy, pioneering labor and civil rights leader, dies at 90. This was written by Sam Roberts and published September 28, 2024 in the New York Times newspaper. The subtitle is, He helped popularize I Am a Man as a demand for respect during the 1968 strike for black sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. Bill Lucy, a trailblazing black union leader who fought for civil rights in the American South and against apartheid in South Africa, and who pressured organized labor to address concerns about equal treatment for minority groups, died on Wednesday, September 25th, at his home in Washington. He was 90. His death was confirmed by his daughter, Phyllis Lucy. Mr. Lucy was not as famous as many other figures in the civil rights movement, but he was instrumental in popularizing a forward evocation of self-esteem and dignity, I Am a Man, which doubled as a demand for respect that was embraced by striking Memphis sanitation workers in 1968 and evolved into a national hosanna. He was organizing the workers for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees when he and the Reverend Malcolm Blackburn, the white minister of Claiborne Temple, were brainstorming what message to place on the protest signs the church had promised to print. They then recalled how the Reverend James Lawson Jr., another lion of the movement, had defined racism a few days before. And finally, we came up with four words, Mr. Lucy said in an interview with the History Makers Digital Archive in 2012. While it means different things, I am sure, to different people, Mr. Lucy added, it meant I'm standing up for my rights. I will speak out. I am speaking back to someone who I have historically held fear of, and I'm confronting the system. And I'm not asking for a whole lot, just to be treated with respect and dignity. And we didn't have any idea that this thing would hit like it hit. The strike by 1,300 black workers who were protesting low pay, poor working conditions, and demeaning treatment lasted 65 days. It was punctuated by the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who had arrived in Memphis to support the workers, and ended with the city council's recognition of the union. Mr. Lucy and others who were involved in conceiving the slogan could not foresee that it would be immortalized as a metaphor for the civil rights movement. In 1969, Mr. Lucy became an assistant to Jerry Wirth, the president of the predominantly white union, and 3 years later he was elected secretary treasurer, a position he held until he retired in 2010. He also strove vigorously to integrate white-dominated unions and to amplify black voices when labor leaders made political endorsements. In 1972, exasperated with the AFL-CIO's public neutrality in the presidential race between Richard Nixon, whom most black labor leaders considered anti-union, and George McGovern, he was a founder with Charles Hayes, Cleveland Robinson, the Reverend Addie Wyatt, and others of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. At the time, he was quoted as saying, "We don't want anybody to be making decisions for us any longer, because we are quite capable of making decisions ourselves. We don't want to be a thorn in anybody's side, but we don't want to be a pivot for anybody's heel." Mr. Lucy was elected the coalition's first president and served until 2013. In the 1980s, Mr. Lucy organized economic boycotts to oppose apartheid in South Africa. In 1990, he welcomed Nelson Mandela, who led that nation's emancipation from white minority rule, to the United States. In 1994, he became the first black president of Public Services International, a federation of union members who work in social services, healthcare, and other government and civic positions around the world. William Lucy was born on November 26, 1933, in segregated Memphis and raised in Richmond, California, in the Bay Area. His father, Joseph, worked as a laborer for Memphis Light Gas and Water, then as a welder in the Kaiser Shipyards in California during World War II and later as an auto mechanic and ranch foreman. His mother, Susie Gibbs Lucy, was a seamstress and managed a restaurant. After graduating from high school, Bill was hired as a dock rigger at the Mare Island Naval Shipyard in Vallejo, California. He later joined the Navy and studied civil engineering at the University of California, Berkeley. In 1953, he married Dorothea Rader. She died in 2000. In addition to his daughter Phyllis, he is survived by another daughter, Benita Lucy Marsh, and four grandchildren. A son, William Lucy Jr., died in 1977. In the mid-1950s, after being hired as a materials and research engineer, testing highway materials for Contra Costa County, Mr. Lucy gravitated to union organizing. He joined Local 1675 of the Civil Service Union in 1956 when he was 23. 10 years later, he was elected its president. In 1966, Mr. Lucy left his job in civil engineering at Contra Costa County to work full-time for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees National Office in Washington as the Associate Director of the Legislation and Community Affairs Departments. At the time, he was one of the most prominent black elected union officials in the nation. Lee Saunders, the president of the Federation, hailed Mr. Lucy in a statement after his death as one of our greatest warriors ever for civil rights, labor rights, and human rights. Reflecting in the History Makers interview on the impact of the words, I am a man, Mr. Lucy said that for the striking sanitation workers, it was their sort of fight back statement, you know, to all of the problems they've ever had for all of the years they'd ever lived there, worked there, or grew up in the South. In the South, he added, you could go from boy to uncle to grandpa without ever passing the position of man. We didn't have to say nothing else. I mean, their commitment to this thing was locked in. That was the obituary titled, Bill Lucy, Pioneering Labor and Civil Rights Leader Dies at 90. It was published in the New York Times newspaper on September 28, 2024. My next reading on today's African American Hour is titled, Black Students at Non-HBCUs Seek Out Sense of Community. This was written by Don Sawyer and was published October 26, 2024 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. Historically, black colleges and universities were established in the United States to provide educational opportunities for black people who had limited, if any, access to higher education. They were designed not only to provide access, but also community. As times changed, access to a broader range of educational opportunities became available and black students began to take advantage of them. While HBCUs are still an essential piece of the higher education landscape, only 7% of black students attend HBCUs, according to the U.S. Department of Education. Black students at predominantly white institutions, PWIs, and non-HBCUs often find themselves in search of the comfort of community. In some cases, the community is waiting for them. In others, students have to create it on their own. At Emory University, Miles Dunn found his community waiting for him on the fifth floor of the Hamilton Homes building, the Black Men's Initiative Immersion Community. The program was created as a resource for incoming freshmen, supporting black men with university resources and spaces that are designed for them. According to Dunn, who originally wanted to attend Morehouse, the initiative's existence went against his previous conceptions of what attending a PWI would be like. I really didn't know what to expect, Dunn said. I never had to interact with non-black people for the majority of my life, so learning how to navigate that was something that was very daunting for me coming in. As an Atlanta native, the experiences Dunn had at his previous schools were distinct. The majority of his classmates looked just like him. Going from predominantly black elementary, middle, and high schools to an institution where black students made up 14% of the enrollment was uncharted territory. For many black students at PWIs, it is intentional spaces like these that are pivotal in finding and fostering community. For Dunn, it was proof that he was not alone. Everybody on that floor were black men, Dunn said. And that made my transition into Emory a lot easier because I was surrounded by a group of black men like myself and like-minded individuals who were all going through the same things. Emory's Black Men Initiative was recently expanded to include the Black Women's Immersion Community, a community open to students of any race or national origin who demonstrate a commitment to black women's academic or social success. It is an opportunity for like-minded individuals to make connections and be able to articulate a positive identity for themselves in relation to the Emory community, according to the BWIC website. The next part of the article is titled, Black Student Organizations. One of the prominent tools utilized by black students everywhere is BSOs, Black Student Organizations. At Emory, Georgia Tech, and even at the Atlanta University Center's HBCUs, these organizations cater to the various interests of black students on campus. In early October, Georgia Tech's Office of Minority Educational Development hosted the 2024 Welcome Carnival to display the various black student organizations offered on campus. Standing at the third table along the quad was Leah Lockhart, a third-year industrial design major who recently found black students in design for Georgia Tech. Lockhart started BSID to address the lack of representation of black students in design-related fields. She is among the many who have taken the initiative to establish community where there seems to be none. We have the freedom to create whatever organization we want on campus, Lockhart said. Why not create an organization geared towards people like me? Black students that are interested in design, that are interested in architecture, that are interested in those skills. Recently, the Immunity Vanguard was created to house all of the BSOs at Georgia Tech and to foster connection among them. Their collaboration is seen in their back-to-school events, joint club events, tailgates, and most notably, homecoming. A homecoming tailgate is hosted each year by Black Greek Organization tents set up across the lawn. At Georgia State, BSOs also participate in a homecoming parade that shows off each organization. According to Dunn, it is events like these that remind him he is not too far from home. The next part of the article is titled, The Non-HBCU Experience. It is not only PWIs that find black student organizations are pivotal. BSOs are also represented at schools like Georgia State, which are not HBCUs, but are also not PWIs. At Georgia State, black students make up the majority of the student body according to the school's website. HBCUs make up only 3% of the nation's colleges and universities according to the United Negro College Fund. And due to the underfunding of these institutions, attending an HBCU can be a luxury that some people cannot afford. Although 90% of undergraduate students at HBCUs received some type of financial aid in 2019-2020, according to the National Center for Education Statistics, the average amount received from grants was $9,200. The average tuition for an HBCU in Atlanta is $27,694, not including the Morehouse School of Medicine. Approximately half of all HBCUs are also private, meaning that state programs such as the Zell Miller and Hope Scholarships cannot be applied as financial aid. For Samir Seymour, president of the Georgia State Black Student Alliance and a member of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity, the oldest black fraternity, financial aid is a factor in his decision between attending Clark Atlanta University and Georgia State. However, the presence of community was not. It was waiting for him at the BSA. After choosing Georgia State, although he did not have to go far to see people who looked like him, Seymour still had to make the effort to find his smaller community within. Crazy enough, the first organization that I joined was Black Student Alliance, Seymour said. For me, coming from a different city and not really knowing anyone in Atlanta, and then meeting them and just starting to build that community and that relationship over time, I'm forever grateful. Founded in 1962, BSA is a collective that aims to unite students from diverse backgrounds throughout the Black community. According to Seymour, the group works to redefine Blackness by breaking the cultural barriers between race and ethnicity. BSOs are typically set up in a way that groups people based on their home country, major, hobby, or external interest. BSA distinguishes itself from the other organizations by emphasizing a connectivity among all the different groups. We try to reach all different countries, different languages, Afro-Latina, Afro-European, African-American, and we try to bring them together to show that there's really no barrier between us all, Seymour said. Because not every school in the Metro Atlanta area has a BSA, Seymour has made it his mission to make it an organization that everyone has access to, even if it's not on their campus. Bringing BSA to the metro area of Atlanta could change someone's outlook of their organization on their campus, Seymour said. Some people might not be having the same experience as we do at Georgia State, but if we were to connect with them, maybe they could help us in certain areas and we could give them tips as well. Organizations centered around connecting people of similar identities and interests are not uncommon at schools in the Atlanta area. In addition to BSA, Georgia State had Chabad of GSU, a Jewish student organization, the Asian American Student Association, the Brazilian Student Association, and more. Growing up, there was always a heavy emphasis on HBCUs, said Dunn, an Emory graduate, but it shouldn't be presented in a way that if you go to a PWI, it is going to be the worst experience you're going to have, because that wasn't my case at all. That was the article, Black Students at Non-HBCUs Seek Out Sense of Community. It was written by Don Sawyer and published October 26, 2024, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. My next reading on today's African American Hour is about golf. It's titled, Worthy of the Attention, Rising Young Stars, HBCUs, Headline Tournaments, Grow Game in North Texas. It was written by Ronald Harrett Jr. and published November 10, 2024 in the Dallas Morning News newspaper. Although the voices of Joe Buck and Troy Aikman filled her living room as the Kansas City Chiefs squared off against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers on Monday night, November 4th, Sharla Brown's focus wasn't on the game. It was on sinking a 13-foot putt on her green and black well putt mat. Golf fills Brown's mind. The 16-year-old moved from North Carolina to McKinney 2 years ago to train with Mark Grovier at Altus Performance Center, which is owned by Jordan Spieth's coach Cameron McCormick. One night in June, as she was winding down and getting ready for bed, her phone buzzed at 12:01 a.m., She picked it up to find her first invitation for a campus visit from the University of Georgia, just moments after NCAA rules began allowing coaches to contact sophomores. Brown, who has been homeschooled since 2020, has since received more than 50 Division I offers in less than 5 months, her mother, Dahlia Brown, said. She committed to Texas in September and is set to join the nation's fifth-ranked women's golf program. For Brown, this is only the beginning. I want to win at least 3 majors on tour, Brown said. I want to be one of the most successful pro-black female players out there. Brown's dedication and her preparation have helped her reach number 28 in the American Junior Golf Association's Rolex ratings. She is also the only black player on the U.S. National Junior Team and was named to the 2023 American Junior Golf Association's Junior All-Star Team, becoming just the second black golfer to do so. However, on her path to success, Brown rarely encounters other black players to compete against or practice with. This week, she'll play in the Southwest Airlines Showcase Monday through Wednesday at Cedar Crest Golf Course, an event aimed at promoting golf in minority and historically underserved communities. She is one of only three junior golfers participating in this year's tournament after her second-place finish in last year's inaugural event. "I don't really feel pressure," Brown said, "of being one of the top black junior golfers in the nation. I feel thankfulness and gratitude for my community always backing me no matter how I do in a tournament. I feel so much support, especially at tournaments like the Southwest Showcase, where there's so many black voices there to support me and the other golfers." Southern Methodist University's Emily Oldwin will also compete in the tournament. She made history twice, as the first golfer from Barbados to play collegiately, and again last spring as the first to win an American Athletic Conference championship at SMU. Oldwin, who began her college career at Texas, said she is eager to participate at Cedar Crest, emphasizing the importance of representation in the sport. According to Golf Digest, less than 1% of the nearly 29,000 members of the Pro Golf Association of America are black, and less than 10% are women. "I remember when I was a kid and I got to watch Maria Stackhouse sink the winning putt for Stanford at the national championship," Oldwin said. "That was so huge for me. So if I can just kind of do that for even one girl, is all I need." Stackhouse was named to Glamour's 21 Young Women of the Year in 2011 and joined the LPGA Tour in 2017. The next part of the article is titled, "Growing the Game." Charles Sifford, often called the Jackie Robinson of golf, broke barriers in 1964 as the first black player to join the PGA Tour, overcoming years of exclusion under a policy that had restricted membership to the Caucasian race from 1936 to 1961. More than 60 years later, diversity in golf remains limited. This year, Tiger Woods was the only black golfer at the Masters, and none competed in last year's U.S. Open. Like the event at Cedar Crest, the inaugural Eastside Golf Collegiate Invitational was created with the mission to promote diversity in the game. The Collegiate Invitational, which took place November 2nd through 4th at Omni PGA Frisco Resort, spotlights talent at historically black colleges and universities and featured four men's and women's teams in the field. "We like supporting diversity," said Brent Bynum, marketing director at event sponsor State Farm. "We like helping people, and when we see an opportunity to do that in the sports environment, we always try to take advantage of that. We saw a real opportunity for State Farm to get involved with something that helps elevate the visibility of HBCU sports." Eastside Golf, founded in 2019 by Morehouse College alumni Olajuwon Ajanaku and Earl Cooper, has partnered with major brands such as Nike, Rolling Loud, and Mercedes-Benz. These sponsorships have funded events such as the Collegiate Invitational. The duo has also launched a successful merchandise line featuring a signature logo of Ajanaku swinging a golf club while wearing a gold Cuban link chain, a design worn by NBA stars such as San Antonio Spurs point guard Chris Paul. The next part of the article is titled, "Super Important." Prairie View A&M women's coach Misha Lavister expressed excitement about her team having the chance to play in the event. "It's super important for them to see world-class golf," Lavister said Monday. "To play on stuff that's not flat and stuff that we really can't get in Houston. It's important for them to see that they too can play at these big events and play at these world-class golf courses, where sometimes they may not have the access to that without tournaments like these." Lavister said one challenge HBCUs face when competing against predominantly white institutions is a lack of facilities. Her team practices at a nearby golf course a few days a week, but on other days, players must make do with limited resources on campus, sometimes even using the football field for putting practice. Prairie View A&M golfer Makaya Joubert, the first black student from her high school to receive a golf scholarship, is in her second season with the team. Arriving at the Eastside Golf Collegiate Invitational, she was thrilled to see a diverse crowd. "Oh my goodness, I see people that look just like me," Joubert said. By age 11, The 5'7" golfer had undergone surgery to correct knocked knees, with the surgeon placing a plate and two screws in each knee to support her growth. While the procedure helped, she still experiences pain when she walks extensively or stands for long periods. Despite these challenges, she has kept her love for golf alive. Now at an HBCU, she's dedicated to raising awareness for diversity in the sport and inspiring others who look like her to pursue golf. That was the article titled, Worthy of Attention, Rising Young Stars, HBCUs Headline Tournaments Grow Game in North Texas. It was written by Ronald Herrett Jr. and published November 10, 2024, in the Dallas Morning News newspaper. Next on today's African American Hour is a story about Spelman University in Atlanta, Georgia. The title is Spelman's Arts Center Gets Star Treatment. It was written by Mirtha Donisdorg and published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper October 26, 2024. Years before their storied careers on Broadway and in Hollywood, before the accolades and awards, LaTanya Richardson Jackson and Samuel L. Jackson were young Spelman and Morehouse college students getting their footing in the industry and in the world. On Thursday evening, October 24th, they were back in the building on Spelman's campus where their love of acting and each other began, attending the unveiling of the LaTanya Richardson Jackson and Samuel L. Jackson Performing Arts Center in the John D. Rockefeller Fine Arts Building. It's the place where, well, I started, Jackson told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The center was named in their honor after they donated $5 million in 2021, which helped spearhead the building's long-needed renovation. The two helped bring in another $12.3 million from friends like Star Wars creator George Lucas and his wife, prominent investor Melody Hobson, to fund the repairs. Spelman contributed an additional $3 million, according to the college's facilities director, Art Frazier. Jackson said it was meaningful to be able to impact a place the way it impacted me, to help other young people come in there and learn the fundamentals of theater, the mechanics, to interpret a story, to inhabit a character, to find a way to do it, and to have people that instruct you and give you the tools that allow you to go out into the world and be the best that you can be. The Rockefeller Fine Arts Building opened in 1964 and was Spelman's first dedicated space for the arts, according to Frazier. Spelman had plans to renovate it going back as early as 1984, but never had been able to do so, he said. It hurt Richardson Jackson to see it fall more and more into disrepair. That building is so much a part of me, she told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It had asbestos, a hodgepodge of air conditioning systems and a lack of handicap accessibility, as well as an outdated theater, dressing rooms, and bathrooms, according to Frazier. It also housed studio arts as well as performing arts, leading to storage constraints. A few years ago, then-President Mary Schmidt Campbell approached Richardson Jackson to outline a plan to renovate the building and the funding the school would need to make it happen. Richardson Jackson took that plan to Jackson and they made the seed donation that would underpin the renovation. Now Frazier said the building has no asbestos, new plumbing, completely redone bathrooms, dressing rooms, air conditioning, expanded storage, and a renovated proscenium theater with handicap accessible seating, upgraded acoustics and lighting. The center's Black Box Theater also was renovated. The building now only houses the Spelman Glee Club and Theater Department. The rest of the arts will be housed at the school's new 84,000-square-foot Center for Innovation in the Arts, which opens next spring. Spelman is widely known for its arts curriculum. The renovated Fine Arts Building lobby is now an airy, two-story glass structure that used to be floors of offices and classrooms. Students, faculty, and visitors are greeted with a massive mural of photos of Richardson Jackson's and Jackson's careers, as well as archival pictures of the former Morehouse Spelman players, the theater troupe the two were a part of. Along the bottom of the mural are 850 names of the contributors and people who took part in Spelman's theater department going back to the 1920s. Pulled from old playbills and other documents, according to the mural artist Quentin Jackson. Morehouse alums and filmmaker Spike Lee, former Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin, and famed playwright and Spelman alumnus Pearl Klieg were some of the stars who attended the mural's unveiling Thursday evening. While Lee was a college student, he saw Richardson Jackson and Jackson in theater at the Atlanta University Center and around the city, and he gravitated toward them. "I was seeing the great work they were doing," I said to myself. "Lord, if I ever get to make movies, these are people that I'd want to work with," Lee told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He went on to cast them in films such as Malcolm X, Do the Right Thing, and Jungle Fever. The couple aren't finished with their support. Next spring, they intend to host a gala aimed at raising $10 million to endow the drama department, Richardson Jackson said. That was the article titled, "Spelman's Arts Center Gets Star Treatment." It was written by Mirtha Donisdorg and published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on October 26, 2024. I'm going to wrap up today's African American Hour with the book review. The title of the book review is Tale of Young Love Takes Ugly Turn. Historical novel details racism, anti-Semitism in the early 20th century. The book being reviewed is titled Ain't No Grave by Mary Glickman. It's published by Open Road Media. It is 280 pages long and costs $21.99. This review was written by Leah Tyler of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Ain't No Grave begins as a heartwarming tale of forbidden love between the son of a Jewish shop owner and the daughter of a black sharecropper. But Mary Glickman's sixth novel quickly evolves into a fascinating retelling of a horrific event in Georgia's history, the 1915 lynching of Jewish-American businessman Leo Frank. Ultimately, this germane work of historical fiction provides a rousing education on the 20th century resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan and the subsequent founding of the Anti-Defamation League. At the heart of Glickman's story are Ruby Johnson and Max Sassaport, two endearing nine-year-olds who are already in love at the novel's opening. They bond after being bullied, but know it's only a matter of time before their friendship is forbidden. As Ruby tells it, their fictional town of Buckwood is the kind of place where one day you had a white friend and the next day you did not. Ruby and Max seek the advice of neighboring oracle Mahaley Lancaster to learn if they share a future. In a book brimming with unique characters, Lancaster is one of the most memorable. A one-eyed woman who lives alone in a rural cabin, she has the long cheeks of a horse, her face plain as a pancake. Like many of Glickman's side characters, Lancaster is based on a historical figure, the first woman to run for Georgia's legislature, a Heard County lawyer who aided in Leo Frank's defense. Ruby and Max's visit to Lancaster's house ushers in their greatest fear, alienation from each other. Separation is their punishment for stealing money from their parents to pay for Lancaster's fortune-telling services. This breach in morality reappears a few times as they bend the rules to stay connected, which in Buckwood means defying their parents and meeting in secret. Lancaster's prediction that Ruby and Max will spend long amounts of time apart before ultimately winding up together eventually launches the duo on their coming-of-age journey that leads from Atlanta to Chicago and back. Glickman uses a fictional figure named Fenton Smalls to provide context for what later happens to Leo Frank and illustrate how early 20th century racism affected different communities. Smalls was a black reporter who was lynched following his conviction for the rape and murder of a white woman before Ruby and Max were born. When Max's Uncle Morris shows up in Buckwood, selling Smalls memorabilia, he includes a lynching postcard featuring Smalls underneath the hanging tree, with picnickers celebrating in the background. Max's father refuses to sell the memorabilia in the family store, but Max is so desperate to raise money to run away with Ruby, he sees opportunity, not exploitation, and secretly charges classmates a fee for an up-close look. Max's involvement comes from a place of ignorance, not malice, but still hurts Ruby and causes conflict between them. There are a handful of other instances where Max participates in activities that trade on the suppression of black Americans. Glickman uses things like a Confederate Day parade to illustrate how white supremacy was de rigueur in the early part of the 1900s. Although Ruby doesn't absolve Max, she accepts the money he collects from the schoolmates so she can leave town before he does. When Ruby and Max reunite in Atlanta in their teens, the reality of living under segregation takes on a deeply oppressive shape. They cannot eat in the same restaurants, ride in the same train cars, or shop at the same stores. The young couple can walk together if they remain unobserved. There is one place they can go, a tavern called Dark Sally's that rents rooms and doesn't discriminate. These social constraints don't dilute their passions for each other. And unlike other young folks who are intimate and face the natural result, Ruby and Max are curiously unburdened by the concerns of pregnancy. The young couple finds work. Max is a reporter for the Atlanta Constitution, and Ruby works at the National Pencil Factory. They save money to move to Chicago as Atlanta reaches a tipping point. The city is already a hotbed of racial intolerance fueled by the reassembling Klan. Citywide anti-Semitism surges when Frank is arrested for the murder of 13-year-old Mary Fagan, an employee of the pencil factory which Frank oversees. Meanwhile, Ruby has a history with Mary she's desperate remains buried. And Max faces increasing danger covering Frank's trial, conviction, and ultimate lynching at the hands of a frenzied mob. As Glickman's innovative storytelling blends with historical facts, Ruby and Max intersect with a multitude of historical figures. While working for Ross, for instance, Max interviews the founders of the Anti-Defamation League. Glickman has delivered an exciting, accessible, and historically informative story about a dangerous time in America's history. Although a wildly entertaining read, Ain't No Grave is also a terrifying reminder of what can happen when the objective shifts from justice to vengeance. In 1986, Leo Frank was pardoned for Mary Fagan's murder. Nobody was ever arrested for his. That was a review of the book, Ain't No Grave by Mary Glickman, published by Open Road Media. The title of the book review is Tale of Young Love Takes Ugly Turn, Historical Novel Details Racism, Anti-Semitism of Early 20th Century. This was written by Leah Taylor and published November 10, 2024 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.